Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 29th. The war in the Middle East is now 175 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. We lost a great American on Wednesday. Senator Joe Lieberman passed away at the age of 82. Hard to believe. Just 1 week ago, he openly criticized President Biden and Senator Chuck Schumer for meddling in Israeli politics. And it doesn't even seem that long ago when Senator Lieberman was the first Jewish vice presidential candidate in America. He was a voice of wisdom, compromise, and bipartisanship. I wish there were more principled politicians like him today. We were supposed to have Jason Brodsky from United Against Nuclear Iran on the program today, but Jason is attending the senator's funeral. So we'll have him on the show next week. Filling in will be FDD's own Sinan Gidi. Sinan is our resident expert on Turkey here at FDD, and he spends a great deal of time these days tracking the many Hamas figures operating in Istanbul, where the terrorist group has a headquarters. We'll hear from Sinan shortly. Last episode, we dissected the U.S. abstention at the UN and the strain that put on U.S.-Israel relations. Now, after holding back a visiting delegation of trusted advisors as a way to protest Biden's decision, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has decided to send them to Washington anyway. Bibi told a reporter that he held them back because he wanted Hamas to know he was serious about winning the war, no matter what the UN Security Council or even the United States said. With all due respect, Mr. Prime Minister, Hamas celebrated the tension between you and Biden. Israel's enemies celebrated the perceived isolation of Israel on the world stage. Ron Dermer and Tsaki Hanegbi need to go to D.C. They need to iron out a plan for Rafah. Israel also needs to show their enemies that the U.S.-Israel relationship is back on track. More importantly, Israel needs to iron out a plan to address multiple Iran-backed threats. I'm talking about Hezbollah in Lebanon, jihadis in the West Bank, the Houthis and the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, and don't forget the Iranian nuclear program. Those threats loom before, of course. The Israelis just thought they had more time to deal with them. They don't. And now they need their most important ally to help. It may not seem like it, but defeating Hamas is small ball. There's a bigger war underway. The U.S. and Israel need to get their act together and quickly, or the American-led order in the Middle East could unravel. Some say it already has. Now for your headlines. Headline one, the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to increase its humanitarian assistance to Gaza, citing concerns about famine. As if on cue, Hamas issued its own statement calling on the ICJ order to be enforced. This showed some serious chutzpah coming from the group that has systematically diverted and stolen humanitarian aid coming into the Gaza Strip. Relatedly, Cyril Ramaphosa, the president of South Africa, the country that first took Israel to the ICJ, published an article in the Washington Post yesterday. South Africa has taken some serious heat here in the United States since dragging Israel to the ICJ. Ramaphosa basically asked the United States to look the other way while South Africa partners with American enemies, China, Russia, and Iran. Also some chutzpah, if you ask me. Headline two. The Israeli Air Force struck the Aleppo airport in Syria last night. So much for the gray zone. Before the war began, the Israelis had been striking a wide range of Syrian and Iranian targets inside Syria. Thousands of targets, in fact. Most of the time, the Israelis would not acknowledge these strikes. We called it the campaign between the wars. Since war erupted on October 7th, there is no more campaign between wars. It's war, period. No need for deniability. So what are the Israelis hitting? I'm glad you asked. It's usually precision-guided munitions, or PGMs, or other advanced weaponry that is sent by Iran to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Syria is where the Iranians usually send that stuff with the hope of bringing it across the border in trucks. But sometimes the Israelis strike Iranian military officials. Turns out last night was a particularly tough night for both for Hezbollah in both Syria and Lebanon. Multiple senior officials from the Lebanese terrorist group were killed. And headline three, Politico reports that the Pentagon is in talks to fund a peacekeeping force in Gaza. There's no talk of boots on the ground, and that's a relief. But the Pentagon is talking about an international peacekeeping force. We've seen these before in places like Lebanon, and they are an utter disaster. They waste American taxpayer dollars, and they somehow find a way to make a bad situation worse. Just look at Lebanon. This comes on the heels of another Pentagon plan. Namely, the Pentagon expects Israel to provide a defensive bubble around that proposed humanitarian port that the U.S. plans to build in just a few weeks off the coast of Gaza. This is yet another supremely bad idea. U.S. forces will be a major target for Iran and its proxies. And now just imagine what happens when there is one U.S. casualty. God forbid. I don't like this. Not one bit. I'm now pleased to tee up my conversation with Sinan Jidi. He's our Turkey expert here at FDD. He's also a terror expert in terms of Hamas in Turkey. He's an associate professor of national security studies at Marine Corps University. Before that, he was the director of the Institute of Turkish Studies at Georgetown University. We caught up with him a few days ago and recorded this interview. I think you'll find it edifying. Welcome, Sinan Jidi.
Hi, John. Good to see you.
Well, let's dive right in here. Let's start with a basic question, which is, what is the traditional role and value of Turkey to the West?
So Turkey is essentially historically a bulwark against the Soviet Union. And that's really the sort of the historical roots in the modern era of why Turkey has been invaluable to the United States, the European Union as it stands today. But essentially, Turkey was positioned as a buffer state, you know, in the early 1950s up until the end of the Cold War. There are numerous essential sort of listening outposts on Turkey's northeastern border, you know, in the past and in today, which is for intelligence collection. We have several air bases in Turkey, not least of all Incirlik, which is sometimes mistaken for a U.S. base, but it's actually a NATO base. And that was actually kind of invaluable to undermining the Islamic State's sort of proliferation following 2015. We have a number of other base structures, but also Turkey serves as NATO's ground forces command and has participated historically as a responsible state actor in numerous conflict zones, which NATO has been involved in, such as, for example, the conflict in Kosovo, possibly in Libya in the early stages of the Arab uprisings. But Turkey historically essentially has been a sort of bulwark, a reliable go-getter that was always willing to contribute troops and manpower to ongoing priority missions for the West.
So, okay, I get all that. I get what the traditional value has been, the historic value of Turkey. Now you have this weird situation where the Erdogan government is openly supporting a terrorist organization. They're openly supporting Hamas. They're providing it with a headquarters. They're providing it with all kinds of diplomatic, political, probably financial assistance, diplomatic passports. I mean, the list goes on. What does Erdogan get out of keeping Hamas based in Istanbul?
So, yes, the actual sort of 180s flip in Turkey's sort of geostrategic positioning as to where it stands with its Western allies and partners is just mind-numbing. It's quite astounding. And you've run through a long list of sort of examples that you can cite. And we could probably sit here and, you know, talk till the evening, you know, for hours in terms of the number of ways which Turkey actively under Erdogan undermines Turkey's as well as the West's, its allies' security interests at large. What does he get out of this? Well, several things. At the very basic level, he gets ideological sort of convictions realized. I mean, we've written extensively on the notion of Erdogan's ideological entrenchment in Islamist movements historically that goes back to his political training for the last 40 years. Since he came to power, he basically dumbed those down and kept them under wraps. But as his sort of ability to consolidate power has gone into overdrive since the, you know, the coup attempt of 2017, he really has dug down into his sort of origins in supporting the Islamic, the Muslim Brotherhood initially, followed by Hamas, as we've extensively written about, possibly Palestine Islamic Jihad, which we are not confirmed with. But, you know, these are all in tune with his ideological convictions, and none of those ever changed. He's a deep believer in Turkey's sort of situation and being situated within these sort of movements. That's a no-brainer. What he also gets is the ability to hedge, right? he's basically figured out, along with some other authoritarian autocratic leaders, hey, why not have feet in two camps, right? I'm a member of NATO. Nobody can kick me out. I'm integrated into the European Union's economy. They really don't want to get rid of me because they're worried about refugee flows from Syria and Afghanistan into the European Union. So they'll basically do what I say, right? And, you know, this administration, for example, was fixated on, you know, enlarging NATO to include Finland and Sweden. And Erdogan's like, fine, I scratch your back. What are you going to do for me? So he's been trying to exact and hedge and leverage his position to get more out of the West, as basically in a terms of hostage negotiation, right? And saying, if you don't do what I want, I've got these relationships with other nefarious networks, such as Hamas, such as possibly ISIS still and remnants in Turkey. And if you don't give me what I want, I will essentially go forward and you know, make life difficult for you, which he has done effectively.
So what you're basically saying here is that Turkey's become a state sponsor of terrorism to one extent or another. And I don't know if you can really get into gradations of that. Either you are or you aren't, I think. So you're looking at Hamas, ISIS, Al-Qaeda. By the way, we haven't even talked about the Turkish support for the Iranian regime in what was known as the Gas for Gold scandal. It's $20 billion of illicit finance between 2012 and 2015, same leadership. So you've got that state sponsor of terrorism dynamic. And then you've got NATO, right? How can you be both? How does Erdogan pull this off?
So he can, because there is no mechanism for removing a country inside of NATO. I mean, you know, when it was designed as an institution, right? You know, it was designed with the mindset of how to undermine and thwart the spread of the Soviet Union, both physically, but also ideologically. They never, you know, its framers never conceived that essentially one day they might have to essentially, you know, take measures against or, you know, precautions against an insider threat or an internal threat, right? And that's exactly where Turkey has begun. Now, let's be clear, he's not wanting to sort of remove himself from NATO as an institution. He just wants to leverage it to the maximum of his interests. He may have, you know, we may have overcome this recent debacle with NATO expansion to include this Scandinavian countries, but Erdogan's kind of just figured out, you know, that I can hold the organization hostage. So what's the next issue that will come up that I can essentially use this position? So that's a big question mark. In terms of this, you know, state sponsor of terrorism. Now, Turkey likely meets the check marks on all sort of U.S. government designations and markers legally as to what, you know, to merit that designation. I agree with you. And we've looked into this quite extensively. But unfortunately, you know, there is no political willpower in Washington or anywhere else to essentially really hold Turkey's feet to the fire on this. One sort of intermediary designation that Turkey could be slapped with, obviously, is a terrorism sanctuary, which would put Turkey on the list of countries which get observed by the State Department and has to be reported to Congress on a year-by-year basis, which, again, there's no political will whatsoever to do. But the Europeans essentially have been somewhat more go-getters on this, and they graylisted Turkey several years ago. What that means essentially is that Turkey is a country which is not taking precautions and active measures to prevent financing or monies going through its financial system to terrorist organizations we identified by the West. And, you know, that's something. But, you know, the conversation between policymakers and decision makers in Washington are not there.
I think that's right. Well, speaking of the conversation, you've injected into the conversation two names, at least, of people that are based in Turkey that should probably be hit with targeted sanctions because of their support for Hamas. I'm talking here about Cihad Yarmour and his organization, Kutad. There's another guy that I think few people have even heard his name, a guy by the name of Mohammed Mushanish. What's going on with these two, and why did you write about them?
So, you know, we just handpicked just two people, and honestly, we could have picked from dozens that we have identified, and likely, you know, our colleagues and friends at the U.S. Treasury Department probably have more names on watch lists or what they're digging up on. But Mushanish and Yarmour are sort of very nefarious persons. Yarmour has been designated by the U.S. Treasury Department following our research and publication on this, so he's now classified as a terrorist by the United States government, specifically because in his case, he is the main liaison. And, you know, this should be a surprise and a shocker to our sort of friends in the U.S. government. He has been identified as the liaison between Hamas proper in Gaza, its leadership, and the Turkish government. He organizes high-level meetings. He's established essentially an organization, a nonprofit organization in air quotes, right, which seeks to promote Hamas's cause in Turkey by doing public outreach events, but also presumably using that institution to recruit members to Hamas from inside Turkey, right? So this should be concerning to everybody. And again, with the Mushanish character, he's been somewhat more elusive and flying under the radar, but he mirrors a lot of Yarmour's sort of credentials. And he has even more linkages that we identify to entities such as Palestine Islamic Jihad, but also other sort of entities such as possibly Hezbollah that haven't been. And these individuals are free to roam entirely within Turkey. Their social media accounts are public. They essentially post whatever they want. You see them shaking hands with people like President Erdogan and other high members of Turkey's government. And the list goes on and on. But it doesn't stop there. I mean, we're also looking into extensive sort of how Turkey seems to be the main base where Hamas's financial transactions, the money that it funnels into the organization in Gaza to the tune of about $1 billion a year, is essentially and most of all funneled through Turkey. And we're not the only ones to say it. Other credible organizations such as The Economist have been, you know, and Politico have really hammered down on this issue. So, again, you know, the trail of terrorism support is extensive. It's nefarious, and I'm not sure, that we should be turning a blind eye to this in the United States.
Well, certainly we don't here at FTD. Let's hope that the U.S. government continues to crack down on some of those illicit actors. Sinan Cidi, thanks for joining us today on the FTD Morning Brief.
Happy to be here. Thank you, John.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. FTD senior fellow Ord Khitri had a letter to the editor of the Wall Street Journal yesterday arguing that in light of South Africa's support for Russia, Hamas, Iran, and China, the U.S. should terminate its special trade benefits and impose sanctions on corrupt officials. Just as Americans once stood with South Africa's people, Ord says we should stand with them now to ensure their leaders stop engaging in mass corruption. Me, I just love that this letter came out on the day that South Africa's president published his op-ed in the Washington Post. FTD's Andrea Stricker and Behnam Bentaleblu are out with a new piece about Iran's nuclear program, building upon the recent threat assessment released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, or ODNI. My colleagues warn that in light of the intelligence community's horrific track record, this new report may be painting too rosy of a picture about the status of Iran's weaponization activities. Behnam and Andrea call upon Congress to hold the intelligence community's feet to the fire. The failure to stay on top of Iran's nuclear progress could be nothing short of catastrophic. FTD's Center on Economic and Financial Power is tracking a new series of coordinated bilateral designations, or bilats, by the U.S. and the U.K. The Brits and the Yanks, as we call one another, sanction key figures involved in Hamas fundraising in the wake of the October 7th slaughter. The FTD team previously identified and called out the online media outlet known as Gaza Now, which was sanctioned for crowdsourcing online donations for the terrorist group. Kudos to my colleagues for doing their research on this, and kudos to the folks over at Treasury for doing what they do. All right, that's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD, and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Tune in Monday for another episode of the FDD Morning Brief. We'll have all the news and analysis you need to start your week. Have a great weekend, folks. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FDD. Thank you.